We're going to launch an online version of the Issues Etc. Journal on June the 1st, and you can subscribe by sending your name and email address to journal@issuesetc.org. Do Christians make progress in their good works? I've written an article for the new online journal titled Sheep Don't Keep Track. You'll also find an article detailing Pastor George Borghardt's journey from Catholicism to Lutheranism. Get your copy of the Issues Etc. Journal by sending your name and email address to journal@issuesetc.org.
It could be that at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved by probably some kind of Darwinian means to a very, very high level of technology and designed a form of life that they seeded onto perhaps this planet. Now, that is a possibility and intriguing.
Wait a second. Richard Dawkins thought intelligent design might be a legitimate pursuit?
And that designer could well be a higher intelligence from elsewhere in the universe. Well, but that higher intelligence would itself have had to have come about by some explicable or ultimately explicable process.
So Professor Dawkins was not against intelligent design, just certain types of designers, such as God.
Well, that's a clip from the movie Expelled featuring well-known atheist Richard Dawkins trying to at least come up with some explanation, pushing off down the line the origin of life to an alien race of great intelligence and advancement and evolution, but not God. There's a designer out there, perhaps, says Richard Dawkins, but it certainly cannot be God. It, of course, is a debate that continues and is often filled with misinformation. We're going to be talking about creation, evolution, the debate between the two, and what you need to know for the remainder of this hour of Issues, etc. It's Wednesday afternoon, May the 13th. Dr. Ron Rhodes joins us. He's president of Reasoning from the Scriptures Ministries based in Frisco, Texas, and author of numerous books, including 10 Things You Need to Know About the Creation versus Evolution Debate. Ron, welcome back.
Well, thanks. Good to be with you today.
I find it astonishing that Richard Dawkins, being an atheist, is willing to believe in aliens that seeded our planet with a designed form of life. How is it that he will believe this, but not in a designer who might well be God?
Well, I think there's probably a number of reasons. I think, first of all, there's a strong anti-supernatural bias. There's a strong anti-miracle bias. And if you admit the possibility of miracles, if you admit the possibility of the supernatural, then they're going to say that science is impossible. You know as well as I do that naturalism as a philosophy reigns supreme on college campuses and universities, and that's basically the philosophy says that nature explains virtually everything, that we don't need to appeal to a God for, you know, man or for animals or for anything else in the universe. And so I think that philosophy has virtually poisoned every argument that he's offering in favor of evolution.
All right. One of the things that I find a bit disconcerting is the fact that Christians, while they do, as you say in your book, hold a diverse set of views when it comes to the origins of life, some of them, have completely abandoned the notion of a biblical account of creation. They'll nuance it this way or that way to a greater or lesser degree, but a simple, straightforward reading of the first two chapters of the Bible is dismissed out of hand. What's going on, Ron?
Well, I think that very often Christians are trying to reconcile science with their theological beliefs, and they've basically taken Genesis and made it palatable to modern science. You know, for example, modern science would tell us that the Earth is who knows how old, millions or billions of years old. But if you believe the biblical account, then it's obviously much shorter than that, 10,000 years, some say. And so basically, they have adapted their own scientific viewpoint into Genesis such that the days of Genesis are redefined. And some people will redefine it in the sense of saying that the days are long periods of time. Other people will say that those are literal days of creation in Genesis, but there's long periods of time between each one. So that's what I mean when I say that they're taking their modern scientific knowledge and trying to force fit it into Genesis. But the problem is, if we use that kind of methodology with Genesis, who's to say we can't use the same methodology with every other book in the Bible? After all, there are other things in the Bible that are hard to understand scientifically. For example, how can there be one person in whom both a divine and a human nature is? You know, Jesus Christ in the incarnation. Are we going to use science to re-explain that? I think you can see the implications of that kind of method.
Then, is there a legitimate halfway house between what people think is a spectrum here, evolution on one side and full-blown creationism on the other side? Can someone find a medium between the two that somehow, although they claim it is, consistent with both?
Well, there are Christians who will say that that's possible. There are those, for example, who hold to a progressive creationism in which they hold to the day-age theory, but they still believe that God was a creator, that he was involved in the process of creating very specifically. That's not the same as theistic evolution, which basically says that God guided the process of evolution. The problem is, though, that when you look at the Genesis account, there's really no textual clues that would indicate that it is anything other than straightforward historical narrative. And the words morning and evening are used in terms of the days. We also know that the Hebrew word for day, which is yom, whenever that's used with a number, it always refers to a literal day. So the problem is that you're basically going against the entire book of Genesis, at least the opening chapters, in arguing that way. And furthermore, what do you do with Jesus Christ? Jesus himself referred to the creation on several occasions, including the creation of Adam and Eve. Would we say that he was wrong on that? And if he was wrong, what does that say about his identity? And so you can see that there's implications beyond just the book of Genesis. I mean, really, Genesis lays the foundation for everything that follows in the Bible.
Let's take a break right there, Ron. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation on creation and evolution, the debate between the two. Dr. Ron Rhodes, president of Reasoning from the Scriptures Ministries based in Frisco, Texas, is our guest. His book, 10 Things You Need to Know About Creation Versus Evolution Debate. Stay tuned.
We're destined to be Darwin's children this time.
The sharpest arrow in your apologetics quiver. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Racism and evolution. Now, what's the connection?
Answers with Ken Ham, whose ministry has opened a high-tech creation museum near Cincinnati.
I frequently speak on the topic of racism and evolution, and I make it clear that not every racist is an evolutionist, and not every evolutionist is automatically a racist. What I say in my talks is that the teaching of Darwinian evolution gives people a basis to justify their racist attitudes about certain groups of people. Let me explain. Charles Darwin taught that groups of people like the Australian Aborigines were closer to the ape-like ancestors than other groups. And because of evolutionary ideas applied to the Aborigines, thousands of bones of these human beings were shipped to museums around the world. See, they were presented as evidence of the so-called missing link. Of course, Adolf Hitler and many other tyrants used evolution as a justification for the killings of millions of people. Now, I'm not saying that evolution causes racist attitudes. It's sin that's the root cause. But evolution and its ideas of primitive and advanced peoples provides a basis for people to justify their racism. All humans are descended from the first man, Adam, not from an ape-like creature.
Ken Ham shares much more about the origin of the so-called races in a lengthy booklet. We found that it's such a great witnessing tool, we'd like to send 10 of them to you for your donation of any size today. Request the booklets on the origin of the races when you call toll-free 1-888-89-ANSWERS, 888-89-ANSWERS, or on the web at answersoffer.org.
We're going to launch an online version of the Issues Etc. Journal on June the 1st, and you can subscribe by sending your name and email address to journal@issuesetc.org. Do Christians make progress in their good works? I've written an article for the new online journal titled Sheep Don't Keep Track. You'll also find an article detailing Pastor George Borghardt's journey from Catholicism to Lutheranism. Get your copy of the Issues Etc. Journal by sending your name and email address to journal@issuesetc.org. It's evolution.
Just evolution. Welcome back to Issues Etc. 25 minutes left in today's program. We're talking creation and evolution with Dr. Ron Rhodes. It's Wednesday afternoon, May the 13th. I invite your questions or your comments. 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-MY-IE or TalkBack. At issuesetc.org. So let's turn to evolution and debunk the basics that are presented popularly, at least. What is the biggest problem evolution has?
Well, certainly one of the biggest problems would have to be related to the fossils. As you know, virtually millions upon millions of fossils have been discovered worldwide, and you would expect that if evolution was true, you'd look at the lower strata of rocks and see very simple life forms. And then as each new strata of rock emerges, you'd find increasingly complex life forms on and on up through the present day where we have human beings. But that's not what we see. In fact, what we see is a sudden explosion of life forms on the Cambrian strata as if they just came out of nowhere. And pretty much the species that are reflected in the Cambrian strata are the species that we have today. And one of the problems that you have is you don't see transitions in the fossils. For example, you don't see fossils with a little stub sticking out at the shoulder that would one day become a wing. You just don't see that kind of thing. Every creature in the fossils is fully formed. And so that's been a real thorn in the flesh for evolutionists. Very often you'll see newspaper articles that claim that the missing link has been discovered, and then the more that you study it, the more that you find out that there was much ado about nothing. And so just in terms of the fossil evidence alone, I think it supports creationism instead of evolution.
They claim transitional forms. I mean, you just mentioned the fact that we're treated occasionally to there were 3-foot bipedal creatures that looked a lot like a chimpanzee but had feet like a human being. There's a transitional form.
There's also, like, for example, the Archaeopteryx. I'm sure you've heard that one. That's one that's appeared in a lot of journals and magazines and books and so forth. It's kind of a cross between sort of a bird and a reptile-type creature. It's got teeth and scales, but it's big, and it's supposed to be the ancestor of the birds. The problem is that it's really not a transitional form because it's not portrayed as being in the process of growing any new limbs, but it's a fully formed creature, a unique creature, to be sure. But nevertheless, it's a fully formed creature in the fossils, and so you don't see something transitioning from one species into another species in the fossil records of the Archaeopteryx. And I might also mention to you that there's been other discoveries made in the fossils which portray birds as predating the Archaeopteryx. And so the point that I'm making there is that, the birds certainly did not evolve from the Archaeopteryx because we find birds that predate that creature. And so, you know, that's one example of a popular alleged transitional form. But there's something else that really pertains here, and that is that very often evolutionists see evolution as a unitary process, a single unitary process that includes microevolution and macroevolution. Microevolution refers to transitions within species, whereas macroevolution refers to one species evolving into another species. Now, we do see evidence for microevolution, in other words, changes within species, but very often evolutionists cite evidence from microevolution and portray that as evidence for macroevolution. I hope that didn't go over anybody's head, but that's a very important point to make.
Well, kind of, I think in that vein, what do we do with claims about Neanderthal, Peking man,
various different, they say various different either stages or dead-end branches of the human evolutionary tree.
Well, it's interesting that you mention those, because typically what you'll see is a new newspaper article that comes out and says, Book of Genesis overturned, and history must be rewritten, you know, that kind of thing. Wild claims are often made. And then, again, once the evidence is actually looked at in detail, and they discover that the evidence is not near so convincing as initially thought. For example, Neanderthal man is not a transitional form at all, but it's been found to be a truly human person. He's been recategorized as truly human and was a descendant of Noah. And so that certainly doesn't support evolutionary theory. But what about Java man? You know, Java man, they discovered a single skull cap and a tooth, and later they found a thigh bone that they thought belonged to it, but it turned out to be something that belonged to a different creature altogether. And what they've concluded now is that this was actually related to a giant gibbon-like creature. It has nothing to do with humans. And so that doesn't support evolutionary theory. Piltdown man made all the headlines across the country, but that turned out to be a hoax. You know, there was a skull that looked relatively normal for a human, but there was a jaw that looked primitive and ape-like. And so some scholars thought that this might be sort of a transitional form. But it turns out that the jawbone belonged to a female orangutan, and the human skull bears no relationship to the jawbone. And it turns out that somebody actually filed the teeth on the jawbone to make it look like it was, you know, transitional form. So, again, that turned out to be a hoax. So the point that I'm making is that even though you often read newspaper articles about these different references, further research has always proven that it really doesn't support evolution. And the thing of it is, the newspapers never come back and report on the new findings. You know, they like to have these sensational headlines like Genesis overturned. But when they discover that it doesn't really support evolution at all, I mean, they don't print any kind of retraction at all.
Folks, we'll give away Ron Rhodes' book, The 10 Things You Need to Know About the Creation Versus Evolution Debate, to listeners with the best questions or comments this afternoon, Wednesday afternoon, May the 13th. You can call us or email us during this break. 1-877-623-6943. Call us or email us, 1-877-623-6943, or talk back at issuesetc.org. You said something a moment ago that while natural selection can be said to occur within species to a limited degree, that cannot be extrapolated out to natural selection from species to species. Give us an example.
Well, within every species, you've got DNA. DNA is the code that determines the characteristics of that species. And certainly, there is a tremendous amount of versatility. For example, you've got the possibility of blue eyes or brown eyes or black eyes. You've got the possibility of having a big frame or a skinny frame, tall or short. You know, all those are within the DNA of each given species. But you never see, for example, a dog transitioning into a cat or a horse. You see, even though there's a great variety allowed for within each species based upon the DNA, you never see new DNA code being inserted into the DNA strands that would enable the transition of one species into another. You know, so that's the point that I'm making. We've got all just walk down Main Street. And look at all the different shapes that human beings come in, and the different colors of hair, and their eyes, and their skin color. All of that is allowed for within the parameters of human DNA. But you never see one species evolving into another. That would involve the insertion of all kinds of new DNA code, and that's not what happens in a mutation. In a mutation, typically there's a copying error where code is actually taken out of the DNA.
Scott is listening in his car. Scott, thank you for being patient. Welcome.
Good afternoon. I wanted to ask, from the sense of defending an argument, and I just tuned in about 10 minutes ago, so you may have already addressed this. I believe it was Mike Behe's minimum function or minimum structure argument, and I've had some discussions with people on the other side, the evolution side, and And I'm kind of at a loss on how to go about defending the point. I mean, it just seems so prima facie, you know. It just seems to explain itself when you say it, that I'm looking for the underlying logic on how you argue back when they start attacking the logic behind it.
All right, Scott, it's a great question. I think he's talking about irreducible complexity. What do you know?
Well, I think it's a very difficult thing to argue against irreducible complexity, but the problem is that very often alleged scientific arguments are raised against that and against the whole idea of intelligent design. For example, if you hold to intelligent design, scientific inquiry becomes impossible. That's a very common point that is made. And the point that you want to make back there is that, to the contrary, science is the very basis for irreducible complexity. I mean, it's the same science that helps CSIs do their job, or archaeologists do their job. You know, I mean, or if you're passing by Mount Rushmore and you see the faces carved into the side of the mountain there, very clearly there was somebody that designed that. So, we're not against science. We're open to science, and science actually supports this idea of intelligent design. There's others who say that it's not true science, because true science involves repetition and replication. And you cannot do that in terms of the universe. You can't replicate, for example, an intelligent designer creating the universe, and therefore it's not true science. Well, what about the Big Bang theory that some scientists hold to? Was anybody there to watch that? Of course not. It can't be replicated. What about the Ice Age that took place? Was anybody there to measure that and watch that happen? Well, no, they weren't, but it's still accepted as science.
Dr. Ron Rhodes is our guest. We're talking creation and evolution on this Wednesday afternoon. When we come back, we'll go back to the phones. We are giving away his book, The 10 Things You Need to Know About Creation Versus Evolution Debate, to listeners with the best questions or comments. Call or email during this break, 1-877-623-6943.
All we are is dust in the wind.
Liberal churches interpret the Book of Amos as a manifesto for social justice, political activism, and the economic redistribution of wealth. But does the Book of Amos teach liberation theology, or does it proclaim God's law and gospel in Jesus Christ? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month is the new Concordia Commentary on Amos by Dr. Reed Lessing. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040. The Concordia Commentary on Amos.
The next generation of pastors is more worried about driver's ed and the prom than whether or not they are being called to serve the people of God. Christ Academy is where that all changes. For 2 weeks, high school guys worship, study, and play together and explore their future calling. It's 2 weeks that set a course toward being formed as a servant in Jesus Christ. Christ Academy, June 14 to 27. Registration is open. Call 1-800-481-2155 or visit ctsfw.edu/Christ Academy.
Often imitated, never equaled. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The leadership of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is proposing sweeping changes in structure and governance. These changes would further centralize power in the church's bureaucracy and decrease the voice of LCMS congregations and laity. Stay informed. Read the new broadcast transcripts on this subject. You'll find them at the top of the on-demand page at issuesetc.org. These transcripts are a must-read for every layperson and pastor in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Issuesetc.org. Click on demand.
Thanks for sending us your email. Having produced Issues Etc. for more than 15 years, I can tell you that we've never received email response like this. Unfortunately, we simply can't reply to all of your email. So here's a way that I can almost guarantee a response to your question or comment. Call the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8384. It's available for your questions or comments 24/7, 618-223-8384.
Since the dawn of man is really not that long, as every galaxy was formed in less time than it takes to sing this song, a fraction of a second and the elements were made. The bipeds stood up straight, the dinosaurs all met their fate. They tried to leap, but they were late and they all died. In oceans and Pangea, see a wooden bottom be a set in motion by the same Big Bang. It all started with a Big Bang.
We're talking about evolution and creation. Dr. Ron Rhodes is our guest. He's president of Reasoning from the Scriptures Ministries, based in Frisco, Texas, author of numerous books, including The 10 Things You Need to Know About the Creation Versus Evolution Debate. By the way, when you purchase The 10 Things You Need to Know About the Creation Versus Evolution Debate using the Amazon.com link at our website, issuesetc.org, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click On Demand, and look for The 10 Things You Need to Know About the Creation Versus Evolution Debate by Ron Rhodes. Let's talk with Joe, who's calling from his car. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how are you? Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to know, how reliable is carbon dating, and why is it so often in conflict with the time accounts that we can construct biblically through genealogy and other sources?
Joe, it's a good question. Thank you. Dr. Rhodes.
Well, there has been some dispute as to how accurate it is, and not just by creationists, but scientists themselves. For example, there was some carbon dating tests done on some recent volcanic activity, which indicated that the activity took place millions of years ago, when it, in fact, just took place like a year ago. So it's not an infallible procedure by any means, but there's one thing that I think that's very important to the discussion, and that is the issue of uniformitarianism. And that's basically the idea that if we observe the current processes in our world and see how slow they are, for example, how slow it is for fossils to occur, then we must assume that our universe is millions upon millions of years old because of all the fossils that we've discovered out there that must have taken that same length of time to form. But that's not a logical deduction. The fact is that Scripture indicates that there was a tremendous flood that went over the highest of mountains on planet Earth, and it was catastrophic. And during that time, there was layer upon layer of mud coming in on top of each other, with one layer atop another, each one with animals who have just been drowned, basically. And there are many who believe that that accounts for a lot of those fossils that we see in the Cambrian era. All these animals suddenly just seemingly died quickly, and they're all on the same layer of rock. And so I think that that's a critically important point to understand in terms of the creation-evolution debate.
Don in Junction City, Kansas, says, we also have the barrier of thermodynamics. Evolution cannot find a way around the second law of thermodynamics. I believe he's speaking there of entropy. What is it, and why is it a problem for evolution?
Well, you know, the universe is running down. That's what the second law indicates. And, you know, if you just wake up in the morning and look in the mirror, you'll see new evidence for entropy. And the fact is that our universe is burning out. The stars will one day burn out. Our own sun will one day burn out. And one day our universe is going to experience a heat death. I mean, it's just going to all be over. And the fact is that when that occurs, if there's one thing that we can learn from that whole process from beginning to end, is that it had to start somewhere. It's almost like, if everything is burning out, then somebody had to have lit the candle long ago. There must have been a time when the sun, for example, has a great deal more mass than it presently has, but has since burned off. And so I believe that the first and second laws of thermodynamics really has some pretty powerful implications for the fact that there was a beginning of our universe, that it started at a point in time. And if there was a point in time in which it began, the question then becomes, who was the one responsible for it? And, of course, that's the point that we're arguing here, that it was, in fact, an intelligent designer that created the universe. And that intelligent designer is not an alien race, but is God, the God of the Bible.
Is there a parallel to the entropy argument when it comes to what I think intelligent designers will, or intelligent design advocates will say, is information? That essentially, for instance, the genetic code of any living creature is an information system, and how do you get information out of chaos, essentially, or a random generation of coherent and life-sustaining information? Is that a big problem here?
Well, I think it's a huge problem for evolution. In fact, I was reading an interview with Bill Gates, and Bill Gates is not a Christian, so don't misunderstand me.
But Bill Gates did say that DNA is a lot like a computer program, only it's much more complex. Now, just in terms of one of his programs, Microsoft Word, for example, has millions of lines of code. But DNA is far more complex. In fact, there's so much information in a pinhead of DNA that it would be more than four complete volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So the question is, who wrote the software in DNA, if I might put it that way? Who wrote all that computer code in the DNA? It had to come somewhere. It can't write itself. I've never seen a word processor write its own code, you know, writing beta 1 and then beta 2 and then beta 3 on and up until the program is finished. Programs can't write themselves. Neither can DNA create itself. And so that's a very powerful argument for the existence of a creator. And, in fact, that's one of the reasons why there are scientists today coming to faith. There's no other way to explain the DNA.
Dennis in Michigan emails us. He says, what is the current evolutionary argument for the initial beginning of life? I cannot comprehend how anyone claiming to be a legitimate scientist would assert that information necessary for the DNA strand necessary to sustain life could arise from either a mineral pile or a mud pond or whatever along the lines of what you've been discussing. You got to go back to that first point where you go from non-living to living, don't you, to have a thoroughgoing evolutionary explanation?
Well, in fact, there are those who continue to teach that the Big Bang happened probably around 15 billion years ago, and then our solar system came into existence probably around 5 billion years ago. And then the claim is that 4 billion years ago, primitive life forms emerged out of inanimate chemicals. Now, how does that happen? That's the question. That's the million-dollar question, but that's what the claim is. And then about 1 or 2 million years ago, through the evolutionary process, mankind evolved. So basically what you've got is you've got life emerging from non-life, and then you've got a never-ending series of positive mutations that go from incredibly simple life forms all the way up to human beings, all according to a unintelligent process called natural selection. You know what? There's a lot of people who think that you've got to have a whole lot more faith to believe that than the creation account, and I count myself as one of those.
Then, with only 30 seconds, how would you characterize the fundamental flaw of evolution?
The fundamental flaw is that something gave rise to this universe. Nothing can emerge on its own. And, in fact, that's one of the primary arguments that we have in terms of the cosmological argument. The universe had a beginning. Everything that had a beginning had a cause, and that cause is God.
Dr. Ron Rhodes is president of Reasoning from the Scriptures Ministries based in Frisco, Texas, author of numerous books, including The 10 Things You Need to Know About the Creation versus Evolution Debate. Ron, thank you very much for being our guest.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Joe, if you'd give us a call back, give us your mailing address, we'll send you Ron Rhodes' book, The 10 Things You Need to Know About the Creation-Evolution Debate. Well, Tuesday, June the 30th is a big day for us here at Lutheran Public Radio. We're looking forward to it. It's the one-year anniversary of the return of Issues Etc. to the airwaves, and we're ready to celebrate it, too, with you, right here at the studios of Lutheran Public Radio, where we produce Issues Etc. in Collinsville, Illinois. We are inviting you to come out on that Tuesday, June the 30th, beginning at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, not only to watch the show being done live, but also to stick around afterwards and celebrate with us the one-year anniversary of the return of Issues Etc. to the airwaves, Tuesday, June the 30th, right here in Collinsville, Illinois, at the studios of Lutheran Public Radio. You're invited. Now, we need you to RSVP, and you do that by sending an email to Craig at issuesetc.org. Craig at issuesetc.org. We want to hear from you. Tell us when you're coming and how many you're bringing. Craig at issuesetc.org. Tomorrow, we're going to be discussing President Obama's commencement address this weekend at Notre Dame. Terry Mattingly of Scripps Howard News Service will be our guest. You don't get something from nothing, and you certainly don't get life from nothing, unless the way the biblical account reads it, out of nothing, God creates everything. Now, evolution won't get you that. And evolution doesn't even claim to get something or even life from nothing. They just push the question back. They say a Big Bang, an infinitesimal, infinitely hot, infinitely energetic point, suddenly expanded and eventually rendered everything that we find around us, you, me, everything, clocks, school buses, birds and bees and all of living things, the whole universe. But they're only pushing off the question of where did that come from? Because you don't get something from nothing. Unless, as the Bible reads, you have God creating it. It really is a debate. There is no halfway house between the two. I'll stick with creation. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.